First, according to the State Department of Health Services, more than 16% of Wisconsinites have been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. That's a lot of people, but there's still a ways to go before the state hits what experts consider the threshold for herd immunity. Many people who have yet to get their first shot may be wondering, what's it like? WPR's Bridget Bowden went to get a vaccine and has this report.
Earlier this week, Group 1C became eligible to receive the COVID-19 vaccine in Wisconsin. An estimated 2 million people with certain health conditions are now eligible to get the vaccine, including me. So I took the first appointment I could find at the Wisconsin Center in Milwaukee. As soon as I walked through the door, someone took my temperature. They confirmed that I didn't have a fever and showed me where I could get in line. There were tape markings on the floor to show where to stand, 6 feet from the person in front of me and the person behind me. At the front of the line, they checked my ID and asked how I qualify for the vaccine. Honestly, I was pretty nervous. I'd been reading and reporting about the vaccine for months, and now that it was my turn to get it, it felt completely surreal. They showed me to a table where they asked me a few questions and gave me a form to fill out.
Hi.
Is this for your first or second dose?
First.
Can I see your ID, please?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
After that, I went to sit in the waiting area, a big room with lots of chairs set up 6 feet apart from each other. There were dozens of people waiting. Many of them were waiting alone, but some came with someone who could help them walk across the room or could interpret for them. Every 10 minutes or so, about 20 people were called up for their appointments. And then my group was called.
Good afternoon, everyone. Are there any other 120 appointments? Please come up.
I got in line. At the front, they took my paperwork, gave me a number, and sent me into the big ballroom. I was directed into a curtained area where I met Mary, who would actually administer my shot. She was dressed in a brown uniform, almost like military fatigues.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great.
So glad to have you here.
Thanks.
I sat down next to Mary while she filled out a small white index card with the CDC logo on top, my official vaccination record. I'd seen pictures of these cards on social media, but it was really, really exciting to see one with my name on it.
It lets them know that you got your first vaccine was the Pfizer and it came from this lot.
She gave me a couple of handouts, including one explaining what side effects I might experience.
So you're probably going to have some pain in your arm.
Mm-hmm.
You may get some of the other signs after side effects, but very seldom on the first shot. Most of the time.
She explained that they would keep me in a waiting area for 15 minutes after the injection to make sure that I didn't have an allergic reaction.
Very rare, but we want to be on the safe side.
Yeah. And then it was time for the shot. Mary kept me chatting through the whole thing, which really put me at ease. She told me how she's a part of a federal medical response team and travels around to help out after disasters.
And during these kind of times,
you know, we get to help with cool things like this.
Yeah.
Welcome to Wisconsin.
Thanks.
And next thing I knew, it was over. Mary walked me to the waiting room where I made an appointment for my second dose. After I waited my 15 minutes, I was free to go. There was a swag table by the door, and I grabbed a button that says, I crushed COVID in Milwaukee. I plan to wear it when I come back for my second dose in about 3 weeks. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now we're looking at the history of vaccines and anti-vaccine movements, which in a way go back to even before vaccinations as we know them today were invented. Edward Jenner gave the world's first vaccine in 1796, protecting against smallpox. Subsequent government orders in the UK mandating smallpox vaccination for infants and children were met with the formation of multiple anti-vaccination groups. We're looking now at the history of anti-vaccine movements and why resistance to public health measures goes so far back. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on opposition to vaccines and anti-vaccination movements today and how they compare to ones throughout history? Were you turned around at some point? You were hesitant about any particular vaccine, COVID-19 or the previous ones. If you changed your mind, what did change your mind and get you to go and get it for yourself or your kid? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Rene Nahara is a director of public health and an epidemiologist. He's the editor of the History of Vaccine, the History of Vaccines Project by the College of Physicians of Philadelphia, and an adjunct professor at George Mason University's Department of Global and Community Health. Rene, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, before we look at some of the earliest days of vaccines and even before vaccines, Do you see parallels between past skepticism about vaccines and resistance to vaccines and what we're seeing at least some of here in 2021?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's, you know, that whole thing about nothing new under the sun. Whenever I hear an anti-vaccine group or an anti-vaccine influencer talk about the COVID vaccine and say some form of misinformation about it, I just think back to everything else that has been said about vaccines from before the vaccine, before the smallpox vaccine, which was the first vaccine, with inoculation as well. Before vaccines, we had inoculation. And man, the misinformation about that as well, it's being echoed even today of, you know, it's going to do this or that to you. It's not, it hasn't been proven to be safe, et cetera. So yeah, I see it all the time. I hear it all the time.
Let's look at the early days. And as you say, before we had what we now call vaccination, we had something else. Can you talk about the pre-vaccination things that we did to inoculate people against smallpox?
Yeah. So if you remember smallpox, you're of a certain age. You shouldn't, because it was eradicated from the human population in 1979. But for centuries, smallpox would come around in waves and epidemics and cause a lot of death, up to 30% mortality, you know, and a lot of disfigurement. They would leave you disfigured because it would give you these pox all over your face that were, you know, just horrible scarring, horrible, horrible scarring. And so what people throughout history found out was that if you were exposed to smallpox, a certain strain of smallpox called variola minor, if you were exposed to just a little bit, you know, not too much to get you really sick, but just a little bit to get your immune system going, then you would be immune from all other smallpox variants, you know, afterward. And so they did different things like grind up people's scabs and then dry them out in the sun and give them to people to sniff through their nose. And that was done in China. That practice then went on to the Middle East. And then in the Middle East, what they did was that they would take the pus from a scab of somebody who had smallpox, and they would give you basically an injection of it that was called inoculation. And that practice came to the Americas, to the colonies via slavery. Slaves who were taken into slavery, who were inoculated, were more valuable because they would withstand the ravages of the disease if the disease would come around. And one of those slaves was his name was Onesimus, and he made it to Massachusetts. And he was bought and given to a preacher up there by the name of Cotton Mather. He was, if you remember Cotton Mather, he was involved with the Salem witch trials. So Reverend Mather asked, you know, Onesimus about this inoculation. Onesimus told him all about it. Then Reverend Mather consulted with Dr. Boylston in Boston, and they got letters from all over the world from different colleagues saying, yes, inoculation seems to work, and this is how it works. And not 100% safe, because you could still get very bad smallpox if you got the wrong strain. But, you know, that's the way that it was done. And so when people in town in Boston saw that smallpox had arrived with a cargo ship, Mather and Boylston got into action and said, hey, everybody, let's get inoculated, to which people had a severe, severe response. Cotton Mather's house was firebombed. They were raked through the mud in the press and in public opinion. And they were not successful at preventing the epidemic in Boston. What they were successful was documenting that they themselves were inoculated, that their family and their slaves were inoculated, and that the death rate in those who were inoculated was around 2%. Whereas in the rest of the town, it was around 18 to 20%. So they cut the risk of death through inoculation from smallpox by about tenfold. And so that, you know, was one of the first more documented instances of inoculation working, which lasted for a whole century until we got the smallpox vaccine.
And Renee, I got to say, I mean, if I was a dude alive at that time and Cotton Mather told me, you know, you want me to do what with what? I mean, smallpox I'd be worried about. I probably wouldn't have been firebombing his house, but I might have been a little skeptical. I mean, you could kind of see why people,
this is brand
new stuff then.
Yeah, yeah, no. And then the other thing was, you know, information came from a slave. And so that was the other thing that people were, you know, they were like, are you sure he's actually qualified to tell you all this? But it was confirmed by Dr. Boylston. So, yeah, you know, this was before the era of knowing that germs were a thing. And so people, you know, what, you're going to take pus from somebody and you're going to inject it into me? No, thanks. You know, like, I've seen what happens with other kinds of things that do the same thing. And so, yeah, there was all that skepticism, which was healthy, right? You know, it was always okay to question things. But the firebombing and the raking through the mud and the attributing all sorts of fake diseases to the inoculation itself, that's where we crossed over into anti-vax territory. And when the smallpox vaccine came around 100 years later, same thing. You know, it's going to turn you into a cow because they're taking the cow pus and giving that to you. It's going to make you have stillbirths because look at how many cows have stillbirths after getting cowpox, et cetera. And so, you know, it echoes again and it just keeps recycling. Whereas today, you know, we hear the same things about the COVID vaccine, right? It's going to damage your DNA. It's going to mutate you. It's going to turn you into something else. It's going to give you cancer. It's going to give you, it's going to cause abnormalities of the unborn fetus, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, without any sort of evidence behind it, just fear. And so that's where we get into the realm of unhealthy skepticism.
We're talking to Rene Najera. He's got a doctorate in public health. He's an epidemiologist, and he's editor of the History of Vaccines Project that's run by the College of Physicians of Philadelphia, looking back at some of the history of vaccines and resistance to vaccines. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think should be done to help people feel more comfortable about vaccination? What, if anything, has helped you be more comfortable? A lot of what we're hearing from you in Wisconsin lately is more, when can we get the vaccine and how can we get more supply of it? But are you aware of people hesitant about it? Is that you? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with epidemiologist Rene Najera about the history of anti-vaccination movements, which go back hundreds of years, so since before we had what are technically vaccines today. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you'd like with your thoughts and or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Rene, you mentioned the early days of the smallpox vaccine. Can you take us a little further forward in history now and some more, you know, in the last 100 years or so? What kind of concerns have you seen with people maybe more deliberately spreading misinformation about vaccines?
Yeah, so in the 1860s, the smallpox vaccine was mandated by the British government, and they said, you know, this works. Let's just go ahead and move to smallpox vaccination instead of inoculation for everybody. And the first documented anti-vaccine league, they actually called themselves the Anti-Vaccine League, emerged, the National Anti-Vaccination League, in 1866. And so they, you know, it was interesting. They used everything from it's against our nature, you know, a religious point of view. If God wants me to get sick, I'm going to get sick. This is not natural, to the more libertarian points of view of the government can't tell me what to do. It shouldn't tell me what to do. I am free. I'm not going to take this vaccine against my will, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so that mutates a little bit and comes to the U.S., to Boston, of all places, in the U.S. anti-vaccine league in the U.S. as well. And they actually send out a lot of misinformation by mail asking for donations. And they managed to, you know, question something, saying, you know, this is not natural. This is not legal. It's anti-constitutional. And in the early 1900s, in Boston, in Massachusetts, and a man by the name of last name of Jacobson, he says, no, I'm not getting the vaccine. And the state government says, yes, you are. We're having a pretty big outbreak of smallpox. And he says, well, I'm not, and you can do whatever you want. And so they fine him, and he refuses to pay the fine. And because he refuses to pay the fine, he's facing some jail time. His case goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, Jacobson versus Massachusetts. And the Supreme Court says, no, the state and local governments, by their police powers given to them by the Constitution, have the authority to protect everybody through whatever public health measures they need to put into place. And they rule against Mr. Jacobson. Mr. Jacobson ends up paying the fine. I think it was something like $5, which nowadays is something like $150. But it sets a precedent. There's a couple of more cases, Sucked versus King, that happens. And we end up with what we see now at play in the COVID pandemic. Local and state governments having much more of the authority, much more of the power to institute public health guidances and mandates than the federal government, right? And so, you know, it's again, it's echoing because somebody who was against the vaccine on moral and religious grounds back in 1902, 1903, is why we have the actions from the state and local governments today and backed up by the courts.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Donald on the line in Merrill. Donald, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to talked about how there's a lot of misinformation that's given to people that are anti-vaccine, and I do know some people that are anti-vaccine, and they often feel that they've been attacked and they've been disparaged in a lot of ways, and we as those that have a maybe better education or a better understanding, you know, whether it be medical and whatnot, such as myself, that we need to be more open-minded and be more interactive with those people that have been misinformed. And so I take a more of a proactive approach and really have a sincere, interactive, and encouraging discussion with them to try to find out how they've gotten to the point that they're at, and then try to give them guidance and keep an open mind about why they think or believe the way they do. As a society, I think it would be much more helpful to act in such a way because, as I said again, they seem to be very discouraged by those that are pro-vaccine.
Donald, thanks a lot for that call. And I think there's a lot there, Renee. The basic idea, instead of attacking somebody who is skeptical about vaccines, Donald says, let's talk to them. Let's understand where that skepticism is coming from and talk through things. Does the history
absolutely.
Of these movements bear that out?
Yeah, absolutely. And it works. There's plenty of evidence that people listen to their peers, people who have very ingrained beliefs. They listen to their peers and will act accordingly to whatever their peers are influencing them to do. We see it in the Second Amendment discussion all the time, where gun owners will listen to other gun owners when it comes to gun safety, but are a little more hesitant to want the government or authorities to tell them. And we see it with vaccination all the time. I must say, in the interest of full disclosure, a younger me, used to make fun of anti-vaccine people all the time. Used to think that they were crazy, wacky, loons, you know, all these things. As I've grown older and perhaps wiser, they yet to be determined, I've understood that you know, this discussion needs to be more more understanding, as the caller said, more humble, I guess. The you know, and you have two types of anti-vaxxers in my book, or three, but let's just talk about two. The number one, the people who don't know any better, because they, you know, like the caller said, they're not medical, they're not, you know, they didn't go to school to become experts in biology, and they're confused, they're afraid, they their parents who are reacting to a child who has a bad reaction to a vaccine, etc. So they don't know any better, and to them, yes, absolutely, we need to talk to them, we need to understand them, we need to have their peers talk to them and allay their fears. And then there are the people who should know better. They're the Andrew Wakefields of the world, who have a medical degree, who did the classes and can apparently, you know, earn a degree, and they still spread misinformation, and they're told that their information is bad, that they're told not to do it anymore, and they keep doing it for whatever reason. Many times reasons are financial, whatever. They, you know, for them, little less patience, little less respect. But the discussion nevertheless needs to be respectful. We're talking about something that is very serious, something that for this pandemic is going to get us out of this pandemic and back to normal. Something that for children, you know, polio is gone. Measles is virtually gone. It tried to make a comeback a couple of years ago. It saves lives. And so we need to have a discussion that is that serious about this. And unfortunately, you know, we live in a society where we don't. We get on social media and start flame wars many times. And so, like the caller says, yes, it would help us all tremendously, not just about vaccination, but about many other public health related things, to have a meaningful discussion.
Thanks a lot for that call, Donald. I want to talk, Renee, about the question of mandatory or not for vaccines. And right now, COVID-19 in the U.S., I haven't heard of any local or state government making it mandatory. You mentioned the mandatory smallpox vaccines. We've got the measles, mumps, rubella, where it's mostly mandatory for almost all kids in schools. Can you talk about how governments have weighed that decision over time?
Yeah, so with smallpox, the first mandate in the U.S. was, again, in Massachusetts, and they did it for school children because they saw that, you know, if you lose half of your school children every 8 to 10 years in a smallpox epidemic, that's not good for society. And they saw that well-vaccinated children were not dying. And so they said, okay, you know, if you're going to receive public education, you're going to get the smallpox vaccine. And people pretty much accepted it. And that's been the case with many of the childhood diseases. For the most part, we're talking in the high 90s. Parents will vaccinate their children, 90% of acceptance, because we're dealing with children. You know, a child falls down a well, the entire town comes out to save them. And so we see that with children. Other vaccines, not so much. They get more skeptical the older the beneficiary. The HPV vaccine, for example, really good example, where Texas wanted to mandate it for teenage girls initially and then teenage boys. And there was a very vociferous opposition against it with, again, all sorts of misinformation about what the HPV vaccine was and wasn't. And then we get into the COVID vaccine, right? Where we see the people who are being affected the most are the elderly and people with chronic conditions. And for some reason, you know, at a societal level, I guess, and psychologically, we can talk about that as well. But we don't care as much, right? You know, you had a good life. Sorry that this happened to you. And so that seems to play a lot into these acceptance of these things. And the government, you know, is elected by, at least in this country, they're elected officials, and they have to win campaigns, and they have to make promises and deliver. And so, you know, and public health in the U.S. is political. And that's what leads us to these careful, you know, proclamations about who should get it, who does, who can't, who shouldn't, and who must, you know, the forced vaccination or compulsory vaccination. So, yeah, it's a difficult game to play because of the politics that are involved.
And briefly, just 30 seconds or so, Renee, it seems like for the most part, there's some concern in the U.S., but mostly it seems like people are lining up to get this thing at this point. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we want to get back to normal. We want to just end it and get it over with. And people have seen the vaccines. And, you know, I think today is the day when we cross 100 million vaccines given out in the country. So far, very, very few instances of severe reactions. The deaths associated with the vaccine have been investigated and not linked. And so people are seeing that. And again, they're seeing it from their peers. You know, they're seeing it from people going to get the vaccine and saying, oh, it wasn't that bad. And now I'm immune. Now I can get back to normal. Now I can go see my grandchildren. And they want that as well. And that's what is being seen throughout the whole country. And hopefully it'll continue to trend that way and enough vaccine supply comes around and we get out of this.
Renee, thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's Rene Nehera, epidemiologist and editor of the History of Vaccines blog. He joined us for a look at the history of vaccinations and anti-vaccine movements over the last few centuries.